Right then, this is now talk 13 in the series on the wicked, and what we're looking at here is the question of whether it's right to name names or publicly identify people as a deceiver or a wrongdoer and so on. And so I'd like to suggest to you that there is a time and a place when you need to do that, and in particular we see that Apostle Paul did exactly that on a number of occasions. So the problem with it is, of course, is that people feel uneasy about naming names or speaking openly about a person's wrongdoing, where you name the person, Mr. Fred Bloggs, and name him as a false teacher or as a person who is behaving wrongly. It's something people struggle with, and it is a difficult issue, whether and when to name a person, or whether you should just speak in general terms, you know. And some would say, some take the view that it's never right to name anyone, and you sometimes hear that being said, you know, when someone is named, criticism will then be levelled at the person who is naming the wrongdoer, as if he's doing wrong. But others may take the view that it's not wrong in principle to name a wrongdoer or a deceiver, but it's just too risky in practical terms in case you end up accusing someone falsely. So they wouldn't object in principle, but on pragmatic grounds. So obviously, if you're going to do it, you've got to be very careful. You've got to be very careful when criticising someone publicly, especially if they're a leader, and it should only be done after a meticulous checking of the facts. But nevertheless, be that as it may, the point is that public criticism, where you name someone, is not inherently wrong, and there are times when people simply have to be named. And we see Paul doing this in writing to Timothy about Hymenaeus and Philetus, and this is a little extract from 2 Timothy chapter 2, 16-18. And Paul says, "Avoid such godless chatter, for it will lead people into more and more ungodliness, and their talk will eat its way like gangrene. Among them are Hymenaeus and Philetus, who have swerved from the truth by holding that the resurrection is past already. They are upsetting the faith of some." So these two chaps, Hymenaeus and Philetus, had swerved from the truth, as Paul says. They were teaching false doctrine. They were saying that the resurrection, that means the resurrection of Christians, not the resurrection of Jesus, had already happened. By that they mean the rapture has already taken place. So way back in the year 60 or 65 or whatever it was, probably nearer 67 in 2 Timothy, they were saying that the rapture had already occurred and was not a future event. And even today we hear from time to time people speaking in those terms. So Paul was very concerned at this, and so he warns Timothy in plain terms, and he names those two men. And later in that same letter, Paul also warns Timothy about Demas, who had deserted Paul, and also in particular Alexander the coppersmith, who Paul says had done him great harm and opposed his message. So this is from 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 9-15. And Paul says, "Do your best to come to me soon, for Demas, in love with this present world, has deserted me and gone to Thessalonica. Crescens has gone to Galatia, Titus to Dalmatia." Now they were going quite properly, they weren't doing anything wrong. "Luke alone is with me. Get Mark and bring him with you, for he is very useful in serving me. Tychicus I have sent to Ephesus. When you come, bring the cloak that I left with Carpus at Troas, also the books, and above all the parchments. Alexander the coppersmith did me great harm. The Lord will requite him for his deeds. Beware of him yourself, for he strongly opposed our message." Now, that's Paul speaking very plainly to Timothy about these various people. So there's a number of them who, in various ways, Paul is criticizing them openly and saying things about them. Now, you could argue that Paul was only speaking privately to Timothy himself, not to the wider church. And that might be a fair point, as far as it goes, except that the letters that Paul wrote were all shared with the whole church anyway, and with other churches, and multiple copies of them were made and circulated, which is why we have so many of them today, because there are so many surviving copies of the New Testament. So they weren't. This letter didn't just get read by Timothy; it got read by all sorts of people. But there are also other letters where Paul is speaking directly to a much wider audience, and yet he still names names, as in the letter to the Galatians, where Paul tells all the people in Galatia, not just some private individual, he tells them all that he had opposed Peter. And he says quite openly that Peter had behaved wrongly in failing to stand up to the circumcision party. So he also publicly criticizes Barnabas for the same reasons. But not only does Paul criticize Peter in this letter and Barnabas, but we're told in the letter that Paul publicly confronted Peter in front of people to his face and confronted him about where he was going wrong. If you look in Galatians chapter 2, 11 to 14, it says, "But when Cephas," that's Peter, "came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. For before certain men came from James, he ate with the Gentiles. But when they came, he drew back and separated himself, fearing the circumcision party. And with him, the rest of the Jews acted insincerely, so that even Barnabas was carried away by their insincerity. But when I saw that they were not straightforward about the truth of the gospel, I said to Cephas, before them all," note those words, "before them all, if you, though a Jew, live like a Gentile and not like a Jew, how can you compel the Gentiles to live like Jews?" So note, Paul confronts Peter in front of everybody. He doesn't ask Peter to go into a private room. "Can I have a private word, Peter?" The issue is big. It couldn't get much bigger, really. And Paul has to deal with it publicly because it's so important. But there are also, in other letters, and also in the book of Acts, there are instances where Paul publicly criticized, rebuked, contradicted, or warned churches about either individuals or groups. And a classic example would be the way Paul confronted Bar-Jesus, that means son of Joshua, that means, also known as Elimas. Now, he was a Jewish false prophet who was causing trouble in Cyprus by resisting Paul. He was also involved in the occult. But look how boldly and publicly Paul confronted him. And I'm stressing this precisely because some people just think it's wrong to publicly confront anything or anyone, that we just should never do that. And I'm hopefully establishing that there's no biblical basis for that view, that you should never do that. Obviously, you should be careful how you do it, when you do it, with whom you do it, what you do it about, but you cannot say from Scripture that you should not publicly confront people. Obviously, Paul chose the right people, the right times, and the right issues. But what you cannot argue is that there are no right times, issues, or people that you need to confront publicly, because they clearly are. So let's look in Acts 13, verse 6 to 12. And it says, "When they had gone through the whole island as far as Paphos, they came upon a certain magician, a Jewish false prophet named Bar-Jesus. He was with the proconsul, Sergius Paulus, a man of intelligence, who summoned Barnabas and Saul and sought to hear the word of God. But Elimas, the magician, for that is the meaning of his name, withstood them, seeking to turn away the proconsul from the faith. But Saul, who is also called Paul, filled with the Holy Spirit, looked intently at him and said, 'You son of the devil, you enemy of all righteousness, full of all deceit and villainy, will you not stop making crooked the straight paths of the Lord?'" Now, would you describe that as a sensitive, gently put message, or would you say Paul is stating it fairly directly. It says, and now, it gets to the good bit. And now, behold, the hand of the Lord is upon you, and you shall be blind and unable to see the sun for a time. Immediately mist and darkness fell upon him, and he went about seeking people to lead him by the hand. Then the proconsul believed when he saw what had occurred, for he was astonished at the teaching of the Lord. So, I mean, that clearly got the attention of the proconsul. And so I mentioned that last bit because Paul takes it, he's quite straight with this fella. And God obviously endorses what Paul is doing, because it was God that temporarily blinds Elymas. But anyway, the point from our perspective is that Paul speaks about this man Elymas in front of people, including in front of the proconsul. And would you agree that that's a fairly straight talking message? You son of the devil, you enemy of all righteousness, full of all deceit and villainy. I mean, can you get much straighter than that? And that's being said directly to this man in front of others. I've personally never heard anyone speak that directly of or to or about anyone. And so the public namings of names that I've come across have never been as direct or emphatic or explicit as anything that Paul has come out with in there. So Paul, he not only opposed and exposed Elymas, he was also used by God to strike him blind, although temporarily, and to stop him in his tracks. So I think we can say that God approved of what Paul was doing and saying in this. So another example of what Paul used to do is the way that Paul publicly confronted and rebuked Ananias the high priest when Paul was on trial before the Sanhedrin. So to criticize a man in front of the Sanhedrin, it's like criticizing him in the middle of the House of Commons or something. You know, it's hardly what you call a private venue. It's as public as it gets, and it's in front of all sorts of leading figures. But so what had happened was Paul had been arrested and brought before the Roman tribune, who was going to have Paul flogged until he learned Paul was a Roman citizen. And at that point, the tribune sent Paul to appear before the Jewish Sanhedrin, which is called the Council. Okay, so it's Acts 22, verse 30 to onwards to Acts 23 verse 5. So it spans across two chapters. So verse 30. But on the morrow, desiring to know the real reason why the Jews accused him, he unbound him and commanded the chief priests and all the council to meet. And he brought Paul down and set him before them. And Paul, looking intently at the council, said, Brethren, I have lived before God in all good conscience up to this day. And the high priest, Ananias, commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, God shall strike you, you whitewashed wall. Are you sitting to judge me according to the law? And yet, contrary to the law, you order me to be struck. And it says, those who stood by said, Would you revile God's high priest? And Paul said, I didn't know, brethren, that he was the high priest. For it is written, You shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. Now, this passage is very widely misunderstood, and it's assumed that Paul was a very, very confused individual, and he didn't know who Ananias was. And I've heard people say that. It's assumed that Paul didn't realise that this was Ananias the high priest, or he just didn't realise. That's not what it's about. Ananias was the high priest. He held the highest office in Israel, and the meeting was taking place within the Sanhedrin. As we've just seen, all the council were ordered to meet. So here's Paul standing in front of the entire Sanhedrin, in front of all the members of the council. So for him not to know who Ananias was, it would be like not recognizing the Archbishop of Canterbury at a meeting that he's chairing at Canterbury Cathedral in front of all the Anglican bishops, and just not realizing, oh, that, I didn't realize that was the Archbishop of Canterbury. So whether or not Ananias was wearing his full robes, anybody would still know who he was and what he was from the setting alone. So there's no question that Paul knew exactly who Ananias was. In any case, quite apart from all that, Paul would already know who the high priest was, who Ananias was. Paul had risen very high within the party of the Pharisees, and he must have personally known most of these men. Many of them would previously have been his friends. So, because Paul had been one of the stars of the Pharisees, he was like a young politician, you know, tipped to be a future prime minister, that kind of person. When Paul was converted, he was, you know, on the edges of the top of the Pharisee party. And so remember, Paul knew these fellows because he was brought up and educated in Jerusalem. He's called Saul of Tarsus, but he's only called Saul of Tarsus because he was born in Tarsus. He wasn't brought up in Tarsus, brought up in Jerusalem. And we learn that from Acts 22 verse 3, because Paul says previously when he was defending himself, he said this in verse 3. He said, I am a Jew, born in Tarsus, but brought up in this city, educated at the feet of Gamaliel, according to the strict manner of the law. So what Paul is saying is, when he says he's educated at the feet of Gamaliel, well, of course, there's all sorts of rabbinic schools and colleges in Jerusalem. What he's saying is, he was in the top school. He was being trained by Gamaliel himself. So it's like saying that you learned economics at King's College with John Maynard Keynes. It's like saying, I went to King's College and John Maynard Keynes was my tutor. So if you said that to a bunch of economists, the room would go quiet. If you said that, everyone would know what that meant. And that is what Paul was saying. He was saying, you know, I was in the top school and I was personally mentored and trained by Gamaliel himself. The point being, therefore, Paul knew all these men, or the vast majority of them, personally. He would have been on first name terms with all of them, the whole lot of them. And this is the thing. What was happening here it wasn't that Paul was confused. So his words may sound odd if you misunderstand it, but the explanation is quite simple. So when Paul said, I did not know, brethren, that he was the high priest, Paul was being ironic, or you could say sarcastic. Now that irony would have been plain to everybody present, and probably to most first century Jewish believers who knew who Ananias was. The point is, it's not known to our generation who don't know Ananias. So if you said the name Ananias to our generation, it wouldn't mean much. But they knew who Ananias was. So Paul's point is that Ananias wasn't the legitimate high priest because he'd usurped the office unlawfully. So it's a little bit like Queen Athaliah, the only queen that Israel supposedly ever had. Well, she just appointed herself queen, you see. So if someone was to say of Athaliah, I didn't know she was queen of Israel, it would be the same thing. It doesn't mean he didn't realize that Queen Athaliah had made herself queen. He means, I don't accept her as queen. That's what it means. So Paul was saying, he was not only rebuking Ananias for striking him, which was illegal, he was rebuking him for that, but he was also drawing attention publicly to the fact that Ananias was a usurper and not really the high priest at all. Now, I go into this in some detail in my book 3 about how Ananias, you know, seized the high priesthood and probably murdered people to get there. So he was a villain, And Saul, Paul would have known that Ananias was a villain, and so would the others. And it was like an elephant in the room, which they would all have known about, but were too afraid to speak about. So when Paul said that, although most people in most churches today don't understand that, most, if not all, of the people of that day would have completely got the point of what Paul was getting at. You know, he was saying, you call yourself a high priest. If you were the high priest, I would not speak against you, but you're no high priest. That's what he means. But anyway, the point is this. Paul is not afraid or unwilling to publicly criticize anyone who needed to be publicly criticized, even if they're occupying the position of high priest. But it's not just Paul, so we're not basing this only on what Paul did, because the prophet Jeremiah also named names. For example, when he publicly identified Shemaiah and also Hananiah. And let's look at this. So chapters 28 and 29 of Jeremiah contain some very direct statements about a number of false prophets whom Jeremiah publicly contradicts, and he publicly calls them false prophets. Well, that, you can't get much more straight than that, can you? So, and he does this to them personally, but also in the presence of others. So Jeremiah doesn't leave it to the people to work out for themselves who he might be referring to. He makes it unmistakably clear. So to begin with, he publicly disagrees with the prophet Hananiah. And he'd been telling the king and the people that they would have victory over the invader Nebuchadnezzar. That's what they've been saying. And Jeremiah spells out that those prophecies are false. And we're told in chapter 28, verse 5, that he does this in the temple. And it says, in the presence of the priests and all the people who were standing in the house of the Lord. Well, the temple's not a small place. There have been a lot of people there that would have heard Jeremiah saying this. So Jeremiah confronts them in the most public way possible, really. How could it be any more public than that? But later, he also goes to see the prophet Hananiah, and he tells him to his face that God has not sent him and that his prophecy is false. And it's in Jeremiah 28:15-17. It says, and Jeremiah the prophet said to the prophet Hananiah, listen, Hananiah, the Lord has not sent you, and you have made this people trust in a lie. Therefore, thus says the Lord, behold, I will remove you from the face of the earth. This year you shall die, because you have uttered rebellion against the Lord. In the same year, in the seventh month, the prophet Hananiah died. Now that, would you agree, is a fairly direct and somewhat assertive statement to make to someone? I would have thought so. So, admittedly, this second confrontation with Hananiah might possibly have been done in private. We're not told whether it was in public or private, but the previous one was in public, so there's no reason to say, oh, it must have been in private, because it was quite straightforward. You know, he was being quite straight with him. Well, he was being straight with him beforehand, so there's no logical reason to assume that it must have been in private. At any rate, we're not told, but there's no reason to think it was in private. But even if it was in private, the point is that Jeremiah is being utterly frank with this man in a way that most church leaders today would not be willing to be, even in private, no matter how serious the issues were. I mean, in some ways it'd be a big step forward if church leaders were willing to rebuke or contradict each other even in private. But I mean, the vast majority of church leaders are not willing to contradict or rebuke anybody even one-to-one, just not willing to. But Jeremiah goes further, because we see in chapter 29, Jeremiah's in action again, and he begins by sending a letter in a very public way, and we're even told of the many and varied people to whom it was sent. In Jeremiah 29:1 it says, these are the words of the letter that Jeremiah the prophet sent from Jerusalem to the surviving elders of the exiles, and to the priests, the prophets, and all the people whom Nebuchadnezzar had taken into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. So in that letter, Jeremiah is again unmistakably clear and frank about the falseness of the prophecies being given by Hananiah, Shemaiah and others. And he goes as far as to say this in verses 8 and 9. He says, "For thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, do not let your prophets and your diviners who are among you deceive you, and do not listen to the dreams that they dream, for it is a lie that they are prophesying to you in my name. I did not send them, declares the Lord." So, that's straight talk. But later, Jeremiah hears a letter being read out, which Shemaiah had sent to the king, in which further false prophecies are made. And Jeremiah responds to that very directly, and he says that God will punish Shemaiah. Now, I mean, just take note of all this. We're not just saying, "Oh, by the way, Shemaiah, I'm just a little uncertain about some of the things you're saying. I wonder whether we could clarify it, because I'm not quite sure I can see it from your perspective." Paul isn't saying Jeremiah's not saying things like that. We're talking about God putting people to death and rebuking them as false prophets, and that God hasn't sent them, and so forth. This is very straight talk. So, look here in Jeremiah 29, verses 29 to 32. It says, "Zephaniah the priest read this letter in the hearing of Jeremiah the prophet. Then the word of the Lord came to Jeremiah, 'Send to all the exiles, saying, Thus says the Lord concerning Shemaiah of Nehelam, because Shemaiah had prophesied to you when I did not send him, and has made you trust in a lie. Therefore, thus says the Lord, behold, I will punish Shemaiah of Nehelam and his descendants. He shall not have anyone living among this people, and he shall not see the good that I will do to my people, declares the Lord. For he has spoken rebellion against the Lord.'" I mean, this is grim stuff. Jeremiah is basically sentencing these men to death, isn't he? He's giving them some really, really straight talking. So, the thing is this as well. Although these men were false prophets, the point is they were still prophets. They are referred to as prophets in Jeremiah 28 verse 5, which refers to Hananiah the prophet. The point is, they'd been called to the office of prophet and perhaps had given genuine prophecies in the past, but they were now giving false prophecies. So we mustn't pick up the impression that it's all right to publicly rebuke someone who's never been a genuine prophet or never been a genuine teacher, but that it's not okay to publicly rebuke men who are leaders and really are teachers and really are prophets. No, that would be a big mistake. The need to publicly contradict false prophecies and false teachings applies always and equally, whether or not the person is a leader, a prophet, a teacher. Indeed, most false prophets and false teachers, they are leaders, and they have been ordained, as you might say, or appointed as leaders. Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing false prophecies. That's where most of the false prophecies come from leaders and men who've been appointed to lead churches. And most of the people today who are giving false teaching and false prophecies and so on are such men, because they're to be found in vast numbers within the denominational churches. So when we speak of a false prophet, we really mean a person giving a false prophecy, but usually they're doing so on a regular basis rather than just on a single occasion. So if it was a single occasion, you'd say that prophecy was wrong. But if a person carries on doing it, you'd really be appropriate to call them a false prophet. So it's not just Jeremiah, it's also Apostle John. He named names and publicly criticized, rebuked or warned people about individuals, and so did Jesus when he rebuked various Pharisees in front of the crowds. So let's look at some of what John did. So John's third letter warns of a man called Diotrephes that John felt had behaved badly. And he also says that when he next visits, he'll bring up these matters, the things that Diotrephes had done. So presumably he means he'll do so publicly with the whole church, because in the first century all serious matters were decided by each local church as a whole, not just by a leader or group of leaders. Now that's something we visualize it wrongly, because most of us today, when we think of a church deciding something, what actually people mean is that the leader singularly, or the leaders plural, three or four of them, they decided. That's not what the church meant in the first century. When they said the church decided, what they meant was literally that the whole church decided. And you see the biggest example of that in Acts chapter 15, when the whole Jerusalem church met and made a decision. The whole church decided, not the leaders. So when John says he's going to bring it up, I think it's reasonable to infer from that he means he'll bring it up with the whole church, not just with some individual leader or group of leaders. So besides that, the letter was sent to the church as a whole, not just to the leaders. And in 3 John, it's verses 9 to 10, it says, I have written something to the church, but Diotrephes, who likes to put himself first, does not acknowledge our authority. So if I come, I will bring up what he is doing, talking wicked nonsense against us. And not content with that, he refuses to welcome the brothers, and also stops those who want to, and puts them out of the church. So that's some straight talk there about Diotrephes. But also let's look at what Jesus does, or did, in the letters to the 7 churches in Revelation, which are dictated by Jesus himself. Remember that. These are letters that Jesus speaks, and John writes down what he's saying. So it's John's taking dictation. In those letters, Jesus says some very blunt things. Now, individuals' names are not given, except in the letter to Thyatira. But whole local churches are criticized, and sometimes very severely. And, I mean, that's not far off what we're talking about, is it? If you criticize the church of such and such, or that church over there, that likewise would be frowned upon today. For a leader or anyone to do that, to criticize that group, never mind an individual. But if you look at Revelation chapters 2 and 3, you'll see the full details of what Jesus says publicly about each of them. Because remember, these letters that were to be sent to the 7 churches, quite apart from the whole book of Revelation itself, but these 7 letters, all 7 letters were to be sent to all 7 churches. They weren't just getting their own letter, they were getting all the letters. And so, but quite apart from there, there are several instances in the Gospels in which Jesus publicly rebukes or criticizes scribes, Pharisees, Sadducees, and teachers of the law. And often he does it in front of large crowds. So his disciples are present right alongside him when he's doing this. But there's also the wider public milling around. Because it wasn't often that Jesus had, apart from when he withdrew into the wilderness, most of the time when he was in towns and villages, he was just surrounded all the time with crowds. So the audiences must have been very large, and yet Jesus spoke openly in front of them and rebuked, corrected, and warned people and groups wherever necessary. He didn't hold back. So, I mean, the classic example everyone knows about is when he rebuked the money changers in the temple. He turned over their tables and drove them out physically. Now, rebuke doesn't get much more public than that. But also, consider the occasion in Matthew chapter 15, when Jesus is approached by Pharisees and scribes who were objecting to what he was doing. And Jesus contradicts them publicly in front of the crowd and even calls them hypocrites. And this is in Matthew 15, sort of verses 1 to 9. And it says, "Then Pharisees and scribes came to Jesus from Jerusalem and said, 'Why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders?'" So when they say that, by the way, they don't mean the Mosaic law. They mean what's called the oral law, which is just a whole massive body of rules and regulations that had built up which they maintained had been passed on by to Moses and on from Moses on to the subsequent generations. These were what they alleged to be traditions that had come from Moses, but really they weren't. They were just traditions that had built up over the centuries of their own, which they were wrongly attributing to Moses. But anyway, there's the point. They're not talking about the law of Moses. They're talking about their own traditions. And he says, why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders? For they do not wash their hands when they eat. He says, he answered them, and why do you break the commandment of God for the sake of your tradition? For God commanded, honor your father and your mother, and whoever reviles father or mother must surely die. But you say, if anyone tells his father or mother, what you would have gained from me is given to God, that's korban, given to God, he need not honor his father. So, for the sake of your tradition, you have made void the word of God, you hypocrites. Well did Isaiah prophesy of you when he said, this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. So Jesus is there publicly slating the oral law, which he never accepted. It's not biblical, it's not from God, it's just men's ideas. And this particular thing he was talking about here, the law of Korban, it's where if you declare something to be Korban, you've set it aside for God's purposes, for God's use. But it doesn't actually mean that you have to use it for that. So if it's set aside, you could either use it for God's purposes or change your mind later and use it for yourself. And that was within the definition of Korban. So what these fellows were doing was effectively exempting themselves from the need to support their parents. They were effectively what you might call today putting the money offshore, put it into a protected trust, so they didn't have to pay for their parents' upkeep. And they were excusing themselves from the need to obey the commandment to honour the father and mother, and using their own traditions as a way of getting round the law of Moses. So Jesus is slating them for that, and lots of other things. But imagine, you see, unless you use your imagination, you don't get this. This is Jesus talking to these leading figures. Can you imagine Jesus turning up today and saying things like that to a group of leaders and clergymen at a big conference, and all the people are gathered and all the clergymen are there with their robes and stuff, and they're all on the platform, and Jesus walks onto the platform, and there they are with the big worship band and all the microphones and everything, and Jesus turns and says things like that, you hypocrites. And that's not the best of it. There's some more stern stuff coming shortly, but you've got to imagine it happening today. How much do you think leaders today would like Jesus and the things he says? If he was here today rebuking the leaders of today's church, they wouldn't be any fonder of him than the Pharisees were. So, later Jesus spoke to a large group, a large crowd again in Matthew 23. And again he criticized the scribes and Pharisees as a group, and warned the people not to imitate them. This is Matthew 23:1-7. It says, then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, the scribes and the Pharisees sit on Moses' seat, so do and observe whatever they tell you, but not the works they do. For they preach, but do not practice. They tie up heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on people's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to move them with their finger. They do all their deeds to be seen by others, for they make their phylacteries broad and their fringes long, and they love the place of honour at feasts and the best seats in the synagogues, and greetings in the marketplaces, and being called rabbi by others. Now you see, what would you think if you were one of the leaders and Jesus said that about you? And what do you think the leaders of most churches at a conference of the such and such denomination or the this or that denomination? They gather together, and Jesus turns up and says that to the men on the platform. How do you think it would go down today? Now do you see why these leaders didn't like him? This is the sort of stuff he'd say to them. This is partly why they rejected him and taught the people to reject him. They rejected him because he told them the truth, and they didn't like him telling them the truth about them. So, but shortly after that, Jesus speaks directly to the scribes and Pharisees in front of a large crowd, and he criticizes them very severely this time, goes into real detail, and he gives no concession at all for the fact that it's being said in public. So this is Jesus coming to the microphone at the on the platform, you know, at the NEC and the National Exhibition Centre. There he is, speaking to the in front of all the crowds. Picture the scene. The leaders are on the platform. Jesus comes to the microphone and he says this. But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men. For you neither go in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayers. Therefore you will receive greater condemnation. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you travel land and sea to win one proselyte, and when he is won, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourselves. Woe to you, blind guides, who say, whoever swears by the temple, it is nothing, but whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obliged to perform it. Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, it is nothing, but whoever swears by the gift that is on it, he is obliged to perform it. Fools and blind. And this is just the warm-up. This is him getting to the meaty bit. And he says, for which is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? Therefore he who swears by the altar swears by it, and by all things on it. He who swears by the temple swears by it, and by him who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven swears by the throne of God, and by him who sits on it. So this is Jesus publicly rebuking the leaders, the teachers, what their teaching is. He's just contradicting them in front of everybody. You've got to picture it, and picture it happening today at a large conference with 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people there. Because that gives you the picture, and just see how it's going down. But he hasn't finished yet, because he carries on. Verse 23. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done, without leaving the others undone. Blind guides who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you cleanse the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they are full of extortion and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first cleanse the inside of the cup and dish, that the outside of them may be clean also. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you are like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but inside are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! Because you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous, and say, if we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. Therefore you are witnesses against yourselves that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of your father's guilt. Serpents, brood of vipers, how can you escape the condemnation of hell? Now then, what marks are we going to give Jesus here for diplomacy, tact, subtlety, and finesse of expression? What do you think? Now, can you see why the Pharisees didn't like him? Now, this is the sort of stuff you read by. You can just drive by at 70 miles an hour reading all this stuff and not get it. He's really lacing into them. And they had to be there because they were required to witness the miracles and validate the healings and verify whether they were right or not. So in a certain sense, they were sort of on duty and had to be at his meetings. That's why there's so many of them all the time. You know, there was no shortage of Pharisees around Jesus, even though so many of them didn't like him. But I think some of the fellows who were hearing this would have been cut to the quick by it. And that's why we know later in the book of Acts that many of the priests and many of the leaders followed him, but most of them didn't. And so that's the way Jesus spoke. Now, I don't know anybody who's ever spoken anything like as straightforwardly as that. So that most of the time when objection is made to some kind of rebuke or criticism or contradiction, the objection is made to the mere fact that it is being made, not the manner of it, just the very fact that you're publicly correcting or rebuking or pointing out the wrongness of someone or pointing out someone is a false teacher. It's that that's being objected to. I don't know anyone who's ever been as straightforward or as blunt as Jesus was. Can you think of anyone who's been this blunt? Or even as blunt as Paul, Jeremiah or John? I can't think of anyone who's spoken as straightforwardly as that. So, let's look at some general guidance and instruction that the Bible gives about watching out for, avoiding and confronting those who behave badly or are false teachers. So we'll move away from the theme of specific warnings about named individuals. Let's look now at some general instruction about watching out for, avoiding, confronting those who do wrong or teach false doctrine. And there are many verses that address this and urge us to be vigilant and bold in tackling those concerned. So let's look, for an example, at what John says, Apostle John. In 1 John 2:18 to 19, he says, "Children, it is the last hour, and as you have heard that Antichrist is coming, so now many Antichrists have come. Therefore we know that it is the last hour. They went out from us, but they were not of us. For if they had been of us, they would have continued with us. But they went out, that it might be plain that they all are not of us." And then in 1 John 2:26 he says, "I write this to you about those who would deceive you." And then in 1 John 3:7 he says, "Little children, let no one deceive you. He who does right is righteous, as he is righteous." 1 John 4:1 he says, "Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are of God. For many false prophets have gone out into the world." And then lastly, in 2 John 1:9 to 11, he says, "Anyone who goes ahead and does not abide in the doctrine of Christ does not have God. He who abides in the doctrine has both the Father and the Son. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this doctrine, do not receive him into the house or give him any greeting. For he who greets him shares his wicked work." So you see, here John is being very direct and very critical about categories, types and groups of false teacher and false leader. And he's repeatedly warning us about these people. Deceivers, antichrists, false prophets. He tells us to watch out for them. Now, John would hardly tell us to watch out for them and to identify them if he didn't want us to point them out to others when we do recognise them. So how would it make sense for you as a member of a church, or in particular as a leader, an elder in a church, to watch out for and identify a false prophet, a false teacher, an antichrist, a deceiver, and then just keep it entirely to yourself and tell nobody? How would that make any sense? Why would John be telling us to watch out for them? On what conceivable basis would we read into this that having identified them, John wants you to keep your mouth shut and say nothing? I mean, admittedly, he doesn't say, "And when you find them, make sure you tell everyone." Admittedly, he doesn't say that. But you've seen the way John himself has been acting. You've seen the way Paul and Jeremiah and Jesus have spoken about false teachers. You've seen that they spoke openly about them. On what conceivable basis, therefore, would we infer from these passages that Apostle John wants us to keep quiet if we identify a false teacher? I mean, to me, there's no conceivable basis for thinking that. So, you know, John would hardly want us to identify a deceiver for ourselves, just for our own personal benefit, so that we can avoid his teaching, but then tell nobody else about them. Not tell our family, not tell our friends, not tell our church. You know, if we're a leader, not tell anybody in the church that so-and-so is a false teacher. It just doesn't make any sense, does it? We'd be denying those around us the benefit of our discernment and leaving them to the mercy of men who we know to be wolves and deceivers. So that just would be crazy. So many of us, or some of us at least, are called to be elders and pastors. And if so, one of the primary duties of an elder is to guard the flock. To do that, one of the most important tasks is to warn those that we care for. That's one of the most important parts of guarding the flock, is warning them. So the point of the Bible using the metaphor of sheep in talking about shepherds is that people are vulnerable. Because most of the people in churches can't discern for themselves. That's the problem. They can't discern their way out of a moist paper bag. And so, therefore, it needs to be done for them, practically speaking, by a faithful shepherd, or, realistically, it's not likely to be done at all. If a faithful leader isn't willing to speak up and say, "This man is a false teacher," the realistic likelihood is most of the people in that church won't figure that out for themselves. That's the realistic likelihood. And so it's all the more important that leaders have the courage and the faithfulness and the boldness to speak up. Because if we're unwilling to identify such wolves, how will the flock ever be warned in any meaningful, effective way? So it's no use faithful leaders just giving generic warnings about categories or types of deceiver. Because the problem is that the people can't tell the difference. They don't know what the difference is between true and false teachers or true and false prophets. So unless the names of these men are identified by faithful leaders, most Christians would be none the wiser. Because they wouldn't know which specific leaders or teachers come within the general category that they're being warned against. So it would be a little bit like telling people to avoid negligent doctors or unqualified electricians or, you know, chefs that aren't properly qualified, but without saying who those are. So how would it help you if I said, make sure you don't use an unqualified electrician, or make sure you don't use a lawyer who's not passed all his exams? Well, how would you know whether the lawyer's passed all his exams unless somebody has the job of checking that and pointing it out? So, you know, the Solicitors Regulation Authority, used to be called the Law Society, if people were struck off, or the negligent people were, fraudulent solicitors were struck off, they would publish that man's name, telling everybody that he's been struck off, and then they'll put it online today to say that Mr. Fred Bloggs has been struck off, he's not a solicitor anymore. Now that's what they do, because the people need to be told who are the ones who've been struck off. And so if you just said, oh, you know, don't watch out for false teachers and false prophets, if you said that to the sheep, to the people that you know that you're leading or helping, they would be none the wiser. And so they just wouldn't know. So they wouldn't know who those are amongst all the teachers they come across. So therefore, in urging us to watch out for and confront these people, it's implicit within these warnings that have been given by John and others that there must be at least some degree of public discussion and naming of the people concerned. Otherwise, how could they even be identified, let alone avoided or expelled? How could you expel a person from a church unless you name them? How can the whole expulsion procedure work without the person being named? So, I mean, simply by using your common sense, you have to conclude that there has to be naming. But it's not just a question of using common sense. We can look at the precedent set by Jeremiah and Paul and John and Jesus and others who publicly name people. I mean, they don't have any qualms about doing it, do they? So therefore, what I would say is it's right and necessary to publicly name false teachers and wolves today, such as, for example, Joel Osteen or Benny Hinn or Creflo Dollar or the Popes. I mean, the Popes, who thinks of those as false teachers and wolves? Many evangelicals are far too polite about the Popes, about the leaders of Catholicism. They think that they should be very, very polite and respectful about them. And I'm not suggesting they should be rude about them, but it's not right to think of these men as if they were godly men, because they're not godly men. So John Paul II was a classic example. He was highly regarded even amongst evangelicals. It was assumed that he was a great man and a godly man. But he wasn't. He was a terrible man. And I had no time for him. And Francis, the present Pope, I think he's awful. He's a false teacher extraordinaire. He's, you know, at the top of the class for being false teacher. The only half-decent Pope, actually, was Benedict. And he's the one that had to retire. Nobody quite knows why. He said he retired because he was too old. But that's never been done before. And some people take the view that he was put under pressure to go. But he's the only one, not that I'm a fan of his, but he was by far the best Pope in recent times. And he's the one that had to go. John Paul II was terrible. He worshipped alongside all sorts of people. You know, he had interfaith worship times. And he'd worship with snake worshippers, Buddhists, Hindus, you name it. Everybody except evangelicals. And he said, direct quotation, "Evangelicals are rapacious wolves." He hated evangelicals. And in particular in South America, the Catholic Church is very hostile to evangelicals. Because in places like Brazil and Mexico and Chile and so forth, droves of people are leaving Catholicism and becoming genuine born-again believers, leaving the church, beginning to read the Bible, leaving Catholicism. And that's why the Pope hated evangelicals. But he didn't have any problem at all with snake worshippers. You know, can you even credit that? So the thing, who would you be willing, right, to get together with a snake worshipper and a Hindu and a Muslim and a Buddhist and a dozen others and worship in some kind of congregation together? Would you do that? Well, John Paul II did. So the thing is that we need to be straightforward about this. And too many evangelicals are far too polite about the Pope. I noticed even in the Left Behind series, I really like the Left Behind series. I think it's a very helpful set of books by Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins. But you know something? Those are good men, and I admire them. But they were unduly polite and deferential about the Pope. And some of you may have noticed that, I think in book one of the Left Behind, it speaks about how the Pope was taken away at the rapture. And so the Pope that takes over in the Left Behind books, in the story that they write, the imaginary story of imagining what would happen at the rapture, the Pope that takes over was not the Pope at the time of the rapture. Now, when those books were written, the Pope was John Paul II. And I think that Jerry Jenkins and Tim LaHaye were a bit scared of having the Pope not raptured, because everyone had in their mind's eye John Paul II as the Pope, and that would be saying John Paul II wasn't raptured. They didn't want to be seen saying that. So they, in their book, had the Pope raptured, and then this other chap takes over who's a bad one. But that was misplaced, unnecessary, inappropriate deference and courtesy being extended to an institution that's fundamentally corrupt The papacy is unbiblical, corrupt. It is not of God. It's false to the core. And I'm not saying that because I'm an intemperate, you know, loudmouth. I'm saying it because it's in the most measured way. I mean, I'm the politest man on the planet, and I'm saying it straightforwardly. That is the position. Well, I may not be necessarily the politest, but I'm in the top five on the planet. And the thing is that, nonetheless, that is the case. There's no other way of putting it. The Pope is a false teacher. There's just no other way of putting it. And so are these other people. So it causes consternation when genuine Christians openly name false teachers and abusive leaders. Many assume it's, as I said, it's inherently wrong because it's divisive. They use the word divisive or judgmental. And the implication is that we should all stay silent. So whatever is said by other leaders, we should all just stay silent. And some would say, you just preach the truth and let others say what they want to say. Don't ever contradict. That's divisive. That's judgmental. Well, you certainly do want to get on with preaching the truth. That's absolutely fine. But if your people are hearing rubbish from these other men, they need you to point out that these other men are false. As it's quite often I'll see on Facebook or whatever, I'll hear someone quoting from or sharing something or retweeting something from some bad place. And I've taken to sort of letting the person know, oh, by the way, the person you're sharing is not good. That's a bad ministry. That's not good. That's New Age or whatever I'll say about it. And I think it's important that you do that, because the very fact that the person, for example, has shared it, or more often they'll be talking about it with approval, or they'll be saying they've read a book, or they've got this tape, or they've been to this conference with so-and-so. And I think when that happens, depending on how well you know the person, it's incumbent upon you, especially if you're in a leadership position of any kind, to tell the person, to warn the person. You don't have to say it in a bombastic, aggressive, rude way. You don't have to froth at the mouth and start, you know, going into histrionics about it. But you just need to calmly say, well, I think I need to point out to you that whoever, Fred Bloggs or whatever his name is actually a false teacher. Are you aware that he is a false teacher? Just point it out to the person. What you'll do, at least by doing that, is give them the opportunity to think about it. Because hitherto, maybe no one said anything. Maybe they've told lots of people that they, you know, follow Benny Hinn or Creflo Dollar or someone like that, Joel Osteen, and maybe no one has corrected them, and you're the first. They might have told 50 people, and not one of them said a word. Now, can you see why that person would be, you know, in some ways, have some basis for thinking, well, I thought this man was good. I've told lots of people I follow him, and no one said a word, including lots of leaders. No one said anything to me. Do you see? Well, I think that the ones who say nothing are letting that man down, because he needs someone to tell him. And those people who don't tell him, they might seek to suggest that the withholding of their comment is all based on their magnificent generosity and graciousness. But the truth of the matter is, the silence from their mouths is actually due, more probably, to simple cowardice. They just don't want the hassle, and they don't want to say anything. So we need to say openly about people like that, and about the popes and all false teachers who pervert genuine Christianity, who undermine the Bible, present a false gospel, or who control and exploit people, make money out of people who promote their own man-made ideas and traditions. And it's no use just hinting at these things indirectly or speaking in merely general terms, because the people won't understand you. They just won't. I can assure you, they won't know who you're talking about if you just talk in general terms. And in the same way, they don't recognize themselves. So when the Bible speaks about proud people, you know, or foolish people, or whatever, how many people recognize even themselves when those words are being said. When the Bible speaks about proud people, it's talking about us. When the Bible speaks about sinful people, it's talking about us. Well, how many people even recognize that? Never mind all sorts of tangential hints and references, indirect references to false teachers. They just won't have a clue who you're talking about. So warnings are of little use if they aren't explicit and if they don't clearly identify those to whom we're referring. So having said all that, however, the point is as well that naming names nevertheless must be done with great care. Only do it if you are very sure of your facts and have checked them thoroughly. So I've sought to strive to emphasize the need to be willing to name names, because for most people there is no willingness to name names. But there is another subgroup of people who are not only willing to name names, but they're sort of professional name-namers. And they're always going around naming names and pointing out what's wrong with people and accusing people of things. They are sort of trigger-happy. You know, they shoot first and then think about it. Now, this is the point. So both groups are doing the wrong thing. So those who refuse to name names are doing the wrong thing. But those who are trigger-happy and just regularly, immediately, and without thought or care, criticizing, condemning people, and retweeting and sharing things that have been said by others without checking it, those are also behaving very wrongly. So there's a time and a place to judge other men's teaching and character and to name names, and to identify individual leaders, teachers, ministries and churches. But we need to be extremely careful when we're doing it. So it's like saying there are times and places when you need to get a scalpel and cut a man's chest open and put your hand in his chest and rearrange his heart around and things like that. There's a time and a place for doing that, isn't there? But you're meant to do it carefully. You're not meant to just sort of do it in a sloppy way. So the thing is, as with this, naming names is important and it's needed, but it needs to be done properly, carefully, seriously, soberly, by people who are very, very concerned not to make a mistake. Because if you don't check all the facts thoroughly for yourself, underline the words "for yourself," don't just rely on what you've heard, if you don't check things, you are likely to end up making false accusations about good people. Because the demons will notice that you belong to this subgroup who are willing to name names. And it is a subgroup, most won't do it. You're belonging to this subgroup who will name names. And they'll think, hey, here's a candidate we can use. This fellow here, he's willing to pass on and name names. He's willing to criticize publicly. Let's use him. Let's feed him with information that's false. False information about good people, because this clown will just send it on and retweet it and post it and share it, and he'll start repeating it and saying it. We can really make good use out of this fella. And then all the demons need to do is trick you by feeding you a continual stream of false information to pass on, and you'll then do great damage to leaders who are not actually false at all. And so there we are. You make one or other of those two errors. Both are wrong. So some make the mistake of never being willing to identify any false teacher publicly. And others make the equal and opposite mistake of being too willing to speak out and to do so too quickly without checking the facts. So check things carefully before you do anything. And it's so easy today. You just have to click a little button and there you are, retweet, and there you are, share. And some slanderous statement is now going out to hundreds of people, maybe thousands, just because you saw so and so saying it, so now you're sharing it. So that which used to be said at bus stops can now be said to thousands of people within minutes, can't it? And all the more need to be very careful what you do. So before you criticize a person, you really need to check their theology, check the facts. Don't just pass on a story. I've heard that so-and-so did this. get to the heart of the matter, check the facts of what really happened. And also, if it's false teaching that's being spoken of, if you know someone tells you that this man is a false teacher, he's teaching this or that, well, don't just rely on what someone's told you. Look at that man's material, check it. Ideally, what you want to do is check a whole book of his, or at least a few chapters, to make sure that you're getting it right and understanding correctly. Or listen to a whole sermon on an MP3 or online, or listen to maybe a whole sermon before speaking against it. So don't just rely on a small extract, which may have been taken out of context, quite possibly. Because if you were to pull out half a line or a line or a phrase from someone's statement, you could make that really misrepresent what the man was really saying. So you've got a duty to be careful what you do and what you say and what you pass on and what you retweet and what you post and share. Because otherwise the demons will see that you are a real useful tool to them, and they'll use you to do terrible injustice to genuine people. And be assured, the demons will make sure that the people you're speaking about are the genuine people. They won't have you criticizing the false. They won't feed that to you. They'll feed false information about good teachers. So, James 4:11 says, "Do not speak evil against one another, brethren." Now, of course, that needs to be read and held in balance with all the other parts of the Bible, which we've been looking at just now, where we are told that we need to, where we clearly have to speak evil against one another. What it's meaning here, James is making a general statement: don't speak evil against each other, but do speak the truth against one another when the time is right, when you've checked your facts, when you know what you're talking about, when you've looked into it carefully. So, there are many Christian leaders and teachers about whom I have misgivings, and those range from mild to severe. But my practice is only to condemn a man's teaching publicly if I've personally read or listened to a substantial amount of his teaching, or at the very least, a reasonable amount of his teaching. Now, that would normally mean a whole book, or at least a whole chapter, or a whole sermon, not just a little extract or a soundbite that could have been taken out of context. I mean, it might not have, it might be in context, but until you've checked the context, how can you know whether it's in context? So it's important to make sure that the context is properly understood and taken into account. And also, before you condemn something that someone's saying, or condemn the person for saying it, you need to make sure that it's about a major issue of doctrine or practice. So that would mean a major issue or doctrine would be whereby a false teaching on that issue would lead people astray, perhaps even to the extent of not receiving salvation. And so the issue over which you publicly criticize a man must not be merely a difference of opinion on a secondary issue. So a classic example of a secondary issue would be eschatology. Eschatology is the study of the last things, end time prophecy. Now, that's a complicated subject, to put it mildly. That's a very complicated subject. So if a man disagrees with me about the details of the rapture, the tribulation, the second coming, the millennium, and so on, the fact that he disagrees with me doesn't make him a false teacher. It doesn't make me a false teacher either for disagreeing with him. So disagreeing about what your opinion is on those issues doesn't make you a false teacher. All it would do is make you someone who disagrees with me. Although that is a terrible, terrible crime, the point is, it doesn't make you a false teacher to disagree with me. And on any issue, to disagree with me. But what would make someone a false teacher is where they disagree with the plain teaching of the Bible. So if someone is saying that everybody goes to heaven, nobody goes to hell, that's called universalism, you know. Or some people say that everyone who's not going to go to heaven will be destroyed. You know, they'll just cease to exist. That's a widespread teaching. Now, that's a false teaching. That's not a matter of opinion. So someone else might disagree with me about the precise timing of the sequence of events of the events of the end times. They could well be correct, and I could be wrong about the sequence of events. I could have got it quite wrong, but they could be right, I could be right, and they could be wrong. But whichever way it is, do you see the point? That doesn't make him or me false. But if some man starts saying that we don't need to be born again, or if someone starts saying everybody's saved, or you can be saved as a Muslim, or you can be saved as a Hindu, as Mother Teresa would say, she wants to make people a better Hindu. You know, and Mother Teresa, for example, is revered as a wonderful person, but she was a complete basket case. She was so deluded. She had no understanding of the gospel whatsoever. None at all. Zero understanding of Christianity or the gospel. And so if a person is speaking on a major issue, a primary issue, where someone is going to be seriously misled by listening to them, we have a duty to speak. But if someone is speaking on a secondary issue, we don't. But you know the funny irony? People remain silent when other people speak heretically about primary issues. So nothing is said against men who preach that everyone is saved, or nobody's going to hell, or we don't need to be born again, or everybody's born again, or little is said to contradict men like that. But you know the things that people get very irate about and wave their arms and legs about? It's just the secondary issues. It's only the secondary issues that people get upset about. So for example, I don't want to pick on Calvinists, but let me just use them as an example. But please be assured that I'm not picking on them, because this applies to everybody really. Most people who get upset about secondary issues, not main issues, not primary issues. So for example, Calvinists will get very upset with people who don't accept their ideas about election and predestination. Well, please, explain to me, why do we need to have a correct understanding of election and predestination? What would be the consequence of not having a correct understanding of either of those doctrines? What meaningful or substantive consequence would flow from you not understanding election? Can anyone point anything out? So the thing is, that can hardly be described even as a secondary issue. At best, it would be a tertiary issue. It's a minor point that the Bible does not give emphasis to. So the whole theme of election and predestination is spoken of in Ephesians and Romans, and maybe a tiny bit in Jeremiah and so on, but perhaps one or two other places where it's mentioned obliquely. But really, it's not emphasized. And even where it is spoken of, the Bible is not clear at all about how predestination operates and exactly what's involved in it. God has not chosen to give us a detailed explanation of what he is doing or meaning, or how exactly he causes the doctrines of predestination and free will to interact. He doesn't choose to explain it all to us. But what he does do, he gives us umpteen instances where we're given free will. That's mentioned loads and loads of times, where we're freely able to choose and commanded to choose, and a few references to election and predestination. But the point is this: many people get very, very irate if you don't agree with them about election. But you see the irony of that. If what they're saying about election is correct, then it makes no difference whatsoever whether you believe in it. Because if what they're saying about election is correct, then God has chosen you and will impose salvation upon you irrespective of what you think, say or do. And if you are not chosen, then salvation will be denied to you irrespective of what you think, say or do. So does it occur to you, therefore, if that is your belief, Why then are you cross with people who don't share your belief about election? You see the point? Anyway, that's very specific. My broad point is this. Where people get to contradict each other, where people publicly criticize each other, it's almost always about secondary or tertiary issues of procedure, detail, or the dotting of I's and the crossing of T's, and the proper or improper use of apostrophes. It's that that people get upset about, not main issues. So that's hopefully a balanced way of looking at this whole business of naming or not naming, and if so, how to name and when to name and with what spirit to name. But also bear this in mind, if you're going to name names, you need to realize that you're no great shakes yourself, and there's plenty wrong with you. So when you criticize another man who's got his ideas wrong, or who's wrong on some doctrine or something, well, do it with a spirit of humility and graciousness and kindness, because you may be able to win that person. So do it kindly to the man, and if you're going to speak of the man, again, do it graciously. I mean, the reason that Jesus and Paul and Jeremiah and John were so explicit and direct and very, very emphatic is because they were great men. But none of us are great men. So I would not presume to think that I'm equal to John or Jeremiah or Paul. I wouldn't have the confidence to speak like Paul or John or Jeremiah. So if I thought a man was wrong, I would want to speak confidently, in the sense of saying, well, actually, the Bible says this. But you want to say it graciously. Make sure you're gracious. Okay, anyway, I'll stop at that point.